and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is January 28th, 2025, and this is episode 497. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York, and I'm online with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Italy. How you doing, John?
Good. We've got a new Ethernet cable, and I'm going to be a better radio performer. But, you know, we have a great show tonight, and we can just get to the interview. But people should keep in mind, I think, before they listen to our interview, in 2024, the United States lost an air base in Niger, right in the center of the Sahel, that it had spent hundreds of millions on. And it was a drone base. And it was kicked out by the Niger junta. That was Niger Air Base 201. And what we're going to talk about tonight can be viewed very productively, I think, in the loss of that airbase.
Yeah, I think Nick Turse over at The Intercept said it was the most expensive airbase in the world, which I believe, because
yeah,
why build an airbase unless you can make it the most expensive one, you know? But yeah, they did lose that. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the jihadist movements, the huge expansion. We've mentioned it many times in various worlds of wars, but we're going to get now the go deep into the history and the rise of the main jihadist movements with a friend of the show, Rob Ashler. So really looking forward to this. Let's get to our interview with Rob Ashler. All right, we are really happy to have back with us on the show guest Rob Ashler. He came to us, he's one of these great finds that Radio War Nerd has been so lucky to have over the years. We first met and then had Rob Ashler on the show last year. It was in, late March of last year. That was right after, not long after the ISKP attack in Moscow on the mall and the concert in Moscow. I just looked it up again, and I kind of forgot. I mean, 150 people were killed, and I don't know, 500 or 600 were wounded. That was a huge attack. I want to emphasize again, ISKP, because I know it annoys you, Rob. People say ISIS-K, you know, but no, it's Islamic State Khorasan Province, ISKP. ISIS-K makes no sense. Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, Khorasan. Like, that just doesn't make sense, you know. But anyways, and then Rob did a great two-part series with us last summer on the origins of the Iraqi insurgency. And it was really fascinating to see. Origins are always really fascinating, you know, to see how the sort of brutal Darwinian struggle within the insurgency that eventually resulted in the rise of Zarqawi and ultimately really Islamic State. So anyway, first of all, Rob, thanks for coming back on Radio War Nerd.
Yeah, thanks very much.
As always, glad to be on the show.
I wanted to ask you real quickly, because you also have, you know, fascinating Substack that, and we're going to be, you know, using some of the articles from Substack to talk today about the jihadis movements in the Sahel. And the name of it, of your Substack, is For By Art Is Created That Great Leviathan. Can you explain that just a little bit?
Yeah, it's a quote from Thomas Hobbes, like his book Leviathan, which I read it in freshman year of college, and I was just—it really blew my mind. It's a very impressive book. So, that's hence the name.
Yeah, my college roommate was deeply influenced by it. It sort of confirmed his dark view of the world. So, and he always references it. All right. So I didn't know that I knew the Leviathan, of course. I didn't know that that was an exact quote from it. So today, yeah, we're going to discuss jihadism in the Sahel, especially the group known by the acronym JNIM, J-N-I-M, Jamaat Nusrat al-Islam wal Muslimin, Muslimin. And I just wanted to point out briefly before we start this, looking up JNIM, because they've been pulling off increasingly spectacular attacks in the Sahel. And later last year, they launched this major attack in Burkina Faso that killed, according to what I'm reading, at least 600 soldiers and civilians. This is in the region of Barcelogo. And JNIM also pulled off a really spectacular attack that made some news last September at a military training camp near the airport in the capital of Mali.
Yeah.
And that actually made news. But it's kind of interesting. I mean, with all their attacks, and we're going to get into the whole thing, they don't really make the news here. The only thing, it's just classic Westoid, you know, focus. It's only Russia versus us. That's it.
Yeah.
So, right? I mean, and none of like, and if jihadism or jihadi group attacks make the news at all, it's only if it hurts Russia, you know, or something like that. So how do you want to introduce this?
So there's a lot to get into, but just briefly addressing like what you mentioned. Yeah, it's very bizarre how JNIM is one of the biggest AQ branches in the world. The UN assesses that they have 5 to 6K fighters, but I mean, UN reports on fighter counts are tend to be kind of BS. They're, usually I would even say informed guesses. They really don't. They often get things really wrong. But my personal guess is that they have 30,000 to 40,000 fighters. But one guy whom I spoke to, he's local in Mali.
Right.
He said, I still have a hard time believing this number, but given how much he knows, and Mark, you read the pieces
Flo.
I sent you.
Talking
yeah, Flo. This guy Flo, he'll be a big character in this episode later on. But Flo, he told me that JNIM, according to its internal censuses, has 120,000 operatives, which is an incomprehensible number. But I think the broader point of them having really wide influence and a big number of people under their control is definitely true. And yet they don't make any noise. It was just a Bamako raid, which that'll also come up later, but the Bamako raid, it was 13 fighters and they killed over 80 Fama troops, Malian army troops. They burned down 10 airplanes and a whole bunch of other shit. It was a total disaster for the Malian government. And it makes barely a blip in mainstream media. It's very bizarre.
Yeah. And the Burkina Faso attack, I mean, that was massive. And the only way I ever see it framed as, ha-ha, Russia's having as hard a time as France had sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Or this hurts Russia. And it's, and I don't know how much, if we're going to talk about Russia much at all. And if I am interested in it, you know, how, because obviously a lot of sort of modern al-Qaeda jihadism really starts as an anti-Moscow.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of interesting there. But yeah, why don't we, you've written some great articles for your Substack about this. I mean, your Substack's always very deep, granular level if you want an understanding of jihadi groups. I mean, as you describe it, it's a Marxist analysis of jihadism. And I thought, let's talk about your article, The Outline of the Political Economy of Sahelian Jihadism, because it's really fascinating. It makes sense of a lot of what's going on there. So, yeah.
Yeah. So there is there's some historical context just briefly as to how JNIM came about. So JNIM, its roots are in the Algerian Civil War with this organization called the GIA, the Groupe Islamique Armé. Or the Armed Islamic Group, they were a very deranged, even by the standards of the most extreme jihadism, militant group. It turned into this very ugly, very violent civil war. A group split off from the GIA because they were sick of the brutality and they were we're done with this.
We're talking about the 1990s here,
yes,
right? And
yes.
Because that was a really savage civil war on both sides. But yeah,
yes.
GEO was like particularly brutal. Yeah.
So the splinter was called the Groupe Salafiste pour something. The acronym is GSPC, so the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat. They split off. They reorganize, regroup, and then they in 2005 or 6 they declare for Al Qaeda and they form Al Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, Akim. Akim still exists. They're based in Kabylia in Algeria, that raises a bunch of its own questions.
Why?
Because it's like they're this very clearly very active. Like Akim itself doesn't do operations, but Akim is very closely linked to JNIM, and JNIM is extremely active. And Kabylia is like it's in the heart of Algeria, way up north. Like the government has perfect. Like the government knows what goes on there.
Right. There's
been longstanding rumors that going back to the civil war that like the Algerian government, specifically the intelligence service, has penetrated the jihadists and like sort of instrumentalizes them.
Yeah.
The current theory is that Akim and the DRS, the Secret Service, have like a kind of. They have a deal. Basically, like Akim will not do anything in Algeria, and therefore JNIM will not do anything in Algeria, and the government won't repress them. It'll let them do their own thing.
There's a lot of that in the last, I don't know, post-Cold War era anyway.
Yeah.
You see that a lot in different countries and different insurgencies. Yeah, government saying basically, you can operate so long, and we won't crack down on you hard so long as you don't do anything here. And then from there it goes off into weird directions as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And we know, for instance, like throughout West Africa, there's now like confirmed instances. Like Algeria is like sort of all but confirmed. Reuters recently reported that JNIM has its own sort of non-aggression pact with Ghana, where like Ghana will permit them to use Ghanaian territory for like as a rear guard, logistics, et cetera, and JNIM won't fight them. And like Flo, he often says that like our policy is if you shoot first. If you attack us, we'll attack you. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah,
so, like,
yeah.
what is the political, economic, sort of historical context of JNIM? It's rooted, of course, as all things in West Africa, in the French colonial government. Basically, when a little bit before the French colonial government came in, there were these things called the Fulani Jihads in West Africa, in the current day Sahel, and the Fulani Jihads attacked a bunch of like local governments, like one of which being the Bambara Empire in modern day Mali, and it installed this new Fulani aristocracy. Like was this? It's just like it's looked upon very fondly in Fulani society. Fulani being the pastoralist group, the big pastoralist group in the Sahel, and the Fulani, again for additional context, they're sort of viewed as the problem child in the Sahel as like the terrorist or jihadist organization. You see this a lot. It's like this sort of grammar. Of GWAT, of like global war on terror, where there's always like this one problematic group in Afghanistan, Pakistan, it was Pashtuns, in Iraq, it was Sunni Arabs, here it's Fulani.
And they span across several countries in Sahel, right?
Yeah, they're like definitely
Northern Nigeria and.
Like Nigeria, the three Sahel states, Ghana, everywhere. Like they're like across the Sahel. Since they move, they're sort of hard to pin down by just how they live.
Right. And they were dominant in, you're saying, the 19th century. So just before the French moved in. Right.
So, and they set up the Massina Empire, which is set up, again, it's viewed upon as like this sort of golden age in Fulani popular consciousness. What this ends up doing, though, is that it sets up a very, very hierarchical and rigid society in which there are these high caste Fulani and many thousands of slaves. When the French colonial government comes in, and in about 1905, 1906, they formally abolish slavery because that's like one of the justifications for colonization. Like it's like abolitionist, like the OG humanitarian intervention.
Yeah.
But what obviously the French were not interested in any like justice. So what they do is instead of slavery, it's now sharecropping. The owners, or the masters, they like own all the land. And the former slaves, they still have to basically pay tribute or tithes to their former masters. So, like, in practice, like, the actual relations do not change.
So the slaves are also from a caste of Fulani, or are they different ethnic groups?
Okay. They're also Fulani. It's okay. the exact terminology is it's a bit too complex, but the low caste Fulani are called Rimaeve. Those are the descendants of manumitted or emancipated slaves. And there's the Matiubi, who are the descendants of slaves proper, like at the time of legal emancipation in 1905.
Right. If you go online, you get a lot of argument, first of all, about what Hausa and what Fulani mean. But a lot of people in this area seem to see it as an opposition in terms of domination or class, with the Fulani being a pastoralist warrior and mm-hmm. the Hausa as being perhaps related, but not so warlike. In fact, I read a description of the Hausa where someone was just saying, you know, in fact, the only Hausa who really fight well are the women.
So, I mean, yeah, like due to the past like 15-ish years, the conflict has like definitely been ethnicized in that respect. Like there are these sort of stereotypes. The Fulani were, because they were always sort of hard for governments to pin down, they like has always seen as views like as problematic. But because of the recent conflicts, you have the Hausa who are viewed in that way. You have in Mali, you have the peaceful sedentary Dogon or Bambara ethnicities. The Bambara is like the ethnicity associated most with the Malian state. And we'll get into this a bit later, but one of the top Jainan leaders, he's formally second in command, but his stature is about as equal as the top emir, Iyad al-Ghali. This guy, the second in command, his name is Amadou Koufa. He's himself Fulani. And he denounces the Malian state as a Bambara state in this very like overt ethnic term. It's like, this is an illegitimate regime that we once fought, as Fulani, that we once fought.
So he's kind of overtly Fulani-izing Jainim?
It's a very interesting dynamic because on the one hand, nationalism or like tribalism of any kind is totally antithetical to jihadist ideology.
But well, yeah, it's theoretically
yes
antithetical, but that slips a lot.
Yeah, like in practice, like because Fulani are the backbone of jihad in the Sahel. So like again, my contact Flo, he constantly refers to them as our heroic Fulani brothers, as the ones who have borne the most for the jihad. And again, like this comes back to the reason why Fulani in particular are so militant. This is related to the social hierarchy, where due to the formal abolition of slavery and then like the independence struggle, this social question was essentially elided. It wasn't, because it complicated the whole narrative of like, oh, we're all fighting against France united. We're like building up this like wonderful new project. It raises too many tough questions that are like very difficult for a fledgling post-colonial state to handle. Like it's understandable why they would sort of push this to the side, because you have a lot of pressing issues to deal with, you know? Mm-hmm. What ends up happening though is that slavery in practice essentially persists. There's this really striking quote that I quote in the piece from a Malian official. We, the authorities, thought this phenomenon no longer existed in this country, but it was here, like in the Malian countryside, that I realized that slavery still exists today. The low caste, the Rimaeve, the Matiubi, they have to pay tithes. They aren't able to move up in society. Whereas in contrast, the high caste Fulani, what's ended up happening, like due to, you know, like what you would expect in a lot of post-colonial states, they integrate into the governments. So you have this, there's this customary role in Fulani society called the masters of grass, basically like in putting in charge of like who has access to pasture here, who can bring their livestock here. It's a genuinely important social function, but can be used in a very nefarious and like unequal manner. These masters of grass end up becoming the mayors of communes, and therefore now have official legal power to entrench their like customary social power and like make them even more abusive. Naturally, low caste Fulani find this utterly intolerable. But what's interesting is that previously, before 2012, the really militant group in Mali was not the Fulani, it was the Tuareg, the blue-wearing like Sahara nomads whom the French have like this weird racial fetish for.
Yes.
thinking of, like, this also comes up in a lot of the reading, that, like, the French, they sort of view them as, like, close to white people and therefore will never be, like, controlled by the black man. It's a very bizarre racial, like, very explicitly racial fetish. Mm. But the Tuaregs, they were always the problematic, like, in terms of, like, militancy. But in 2012, like, with the original jihadist uprising in Mali, the Fulani joined. Amadou Koufa, he was part of that rebellion. And the reason for that, it's the exact motivation as to why they began, like why they got involved at that particular moment is a bit unclear. But the long term trends were the Locas Fulani, they were simply sick of their plight, and jihadism was the main political vehicle for that.
Right, radical. I mean, John and I were talking about it earlier. You know, just there isn't a credible radical militant left. Mm-hmm. These days, because that's probably where it would have gone, you know, possibly anyway, where it would have gone 50 years ago or something.
Yes.
But yeah, jihadism is, yeah, where it goes now. But yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that's where it ends up going. And the reason, like, actually, there is I stated it's unclear why they joined at that particular moment, but the Akim, they implanted themselves in Mali beginning in 2006. This was part of their, like, what? One West Point thing, like, writer says, Al-Qaeda is an imperial playbook. Basically what Akim, AQ in general, but Akim in particular does.
Akim, I'm sorry, just to repeat, yep. is Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb.
Yes.
Yeah.
They implant themselves in local communities. They, like, strikingly, they implant themselves in the underprivileged families, not the elite, like, sections of society. Through this, like, through intermarriage, through, like, business connections, et cetera, and then through this, they're able to proselytize their ideology. And Flo, he tells a very striking quote. I'm quoting him here. According to one of the supporters of Jainim from Azawad, that says Azawad is the Tuareg sort of separatist term for North Mali. So that's a very interesting that he says that word. Right. This supporter told me, we were living in superstitions. Then our sheikhs, meaning Akim, came and taught us Islam, monotheism, and the righteous path. Although many of them were killed, we follow in their footsteps. That's basically what the imperial playbook is for Akim. So they come in, they implant themselves amongst first the Tuaregs and then the Fulani joins. And the Fulani joint is this sort of, Gilles Holder is this French anthropologist and researcher. He has this, like, really, the way he describes the Fulani entrance into this, it's the Islamization of social revolt. This is a fundamentally social problem. That the Fulani are rebelling against their dispossession, their oppression within their own society against the high caste who have integrated into the state, and then this other dynamic, which is again rooted in the colonial government, which is this extreme government hostility towards pastoralists.
That goes back, right?
Yeah. Yes, it goes back to, like, it starts, like, the earliest roots of it are 1900 when the French government enacts laws to protect the environment, and this is a very Malthusian idea of, like, people are the reason that the environment, that desertification is happening. Like, the Fulani, the natives, they have no idea how to handle this environment, whereas, like, we French, you know, look at how clean our sand is. We definitely know how to do this. This culminates in 1935, where what essentially happens is the government seizes all unproductive land as state property. Unproductive meaning unfarmed. Mm-hmm. And that is all the lands that pastoralists, like Fulani, like Tuareg, use. And in the same year, the French colonial government sets up the Forest Service, which is meant to enforce this law. It forbids traditional pastoralist activities like woodcutting, drywood collection, nut and fruit picking, livestock grazing, and crucially manage bushfires, all of which are actually good for the Sahelian environment, the particular terrain there. The Forest Service, it's an essentially paramilitary and, like, repressive structure, recruited mainly from, like, it doesn't recruit like police would recruit, which is, like, from the local public. It recruits from the military, I'm pretty sure. Which shows just, like, what the exact mindset is towards the local people.
Yeah, this is not like Smokey the Bear in your local Forest Service
people. No. Like, these are people with guns who will shoot you if you cross them.
It's about order and like land control and people control, really.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
This has escalated and intensified in the 80s, like, after, like, when the socialist Malian government it falls, or, like, socialism as a pretense goes away, and IMF, like, structural readjustment, like, it's affecting the entire world. It naturally comes to Mali. And part of that, like, in the 80s, like, one big thing was desertification. We need to protect the environment in the Sahel from this, like, the onslaught of the desert. So in the Malian government, it thought, oh, we could get, like, favorable deals by really escalating repression of human activity. And this, and there was a revised forest law in 1986 with extremely high fines and very, like, it basically permits Forest Service to do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And it's unsurprising that pastoralists, but really, I think, like, most people, from what I understand, in Mali and these other Sahelian states, they hate the Forest Service because it's an incredibly abusive and unfair government arm. What often happens is that the laws themselves are viewed in a very, like, bad light because they're just what a lot of people think. Like, I remember, even in my own lifetime, I'll remember when I could use these lands, but now the government is saying I can't. Or, like, I can remember my parents or grandparents telling me, like, when we could use these lands. But so even beyond that, the Forest Service agents will use their authority, will use their power to simply extort pastoralist communities. Often, like, demanding, like, the value of, like, entire oxen, which, like, leads, like, there's this one case from Afrique 21, this great French website. They reported a case of a forest agent demanding essentially the value of an entire flock from a shepherd. His tribal chief mediated and was able to get it down to the pretty still high cost of 3 oxen.
This is as a fine or as a tax?
They frame it as fines, but, like, you're not, like, oftentimes you're not supposed to do
it. But it's just a rent.
Yeah.
Isn't there something kind of irreducible in terms of conflict here? Like, does rapid population growth and the movement of sedentary farmers and pastoralists. I mean, on the other side of this big divide between French and British Africa, as explained in a quick book, I think, Colonialism by Proxy by Moses Ochonu, he says the British in their area of mid-Nigeria used Fulani and Hausa subalterns as enforcers in favor of a pastoralist economy against the non-northern peoples who wanted to farm there.
There's this component, definitely, especially, like, as with, like, climate change, like, there is desertification, but the problem fundamentally is one of politics and like, it's a fundamentally political and social problem. Like, obviously there will be tensions, there always will be, but it doesn't have to be this bad. Like, the Forest Service, the government's refusal or inability to confront hierarchies within Fulani society or, like, conflicts between settled and pastoralist communities, like, it's adding fuel to the fire. Like, there is a way to mitigate this. None of which are being practiced.
I mean, it sounds like they, I've seen this again, you know, I don't know, I think of certain arms of the Russian state at least 20, 30 years ago. I mean, it sounds like they essentially created a mafia, which is this Forest Service paramilitary. And I mean, it developed over time into that. It wasn't immediately that, maybe. But eventually, because it has these powers and it has these guns and it has these powers over these people, it becomes essentially a shakedown mafia.
Yeah.
And then that itself, it becomes self-perpetuating because that money gets kicked around to the political class as well. And then and it also happens to tie back into, but we're helping the environment. So it also ties back into getting loans, preferable loans, from international financial institutions.
Sort of like neocolonialism, like ecological crisis, it's all coming together, and like just post-colonialism, it all compounds together to, like, fuck over this, like, very already incredibly poor part of the world. Mm. There's this, like, very striking quote from some local researchers. Forest agents were allowed to keep a portion of the fines collected, which is already, like, the flag, in addition to all the fines they collected informally without receipts, which further encouraged their rent-seeking behavior, leading the paramilitary WFS, that is the Forest Service, to become a vehicle for decentralized plunder across the country, resulting in the Forest Service topping rural people's hate list.
yeah.
So it's this, it's very stark. Like in Burkina Faso, there is this another quote from this journalist, Remy Carvajal. In this heavily forested region, the state has over the years created 11 hunting concessions, 10 of which are managed by private concessionaires, and two huge protected areas, Arley Park and W Park. The proliferation of these areas, which prevents people from cultivating, hunting, and fishing as they please and as they did historically, has sparked frustration and anger against the authorities. People don't understand why they're being deprived of land that was exploited by their ancestors, and even less so that foreigners can benefit from it. Something really striking is that, like, in the 2007 budget of the Burkinabe state, just 3% was devoted to local authorities. The rest of it was devoted to, like, managing the concessions for foreign tourists, basically.
Mm.
And, like, one sort of framing device I use in the piece is comparing it to the Prussian forest laws in the 19th century. It's a very similar sort of dynamic where people are being, like, you have these, like, communal rights that are being taken away. But in Prussia, it was, like, it was proletarianizing the population. Like, at least they, like, were able to, like, work in factories and workshops and stuff. There's none of that here. It's just plunder for very, like, rent-seeking, very parasitic purposes that's weakening the country, worsening internal social tensions, and greatly worsening this transnational jihadist threat. In every respect, this is a fucking disaster.
Right. You know, it also reminds me a little bit, and I say this without knowing the story deeply, and I realize we need to do Radio Warner episode on this, but the Naxalite Rebellion in basically landless, low caste, in the forests and jungles and you know, constantly repressed Marxist and, you know, active and militant. But also it's about trying to, I mean, the Indian state, as it gets more and more oligarchized, you know, they're trying to reclaim. They're trying to take demarcate all the land, because not all the land, they have not been able to basically wall off and sell off every piece of land. And the Naxalites are like the last groups holding out. But yeah, that's for another episode, of course. But it's a similar dynamic in a way.
Yeah. Like it's this peasant / pastoralist economies, like,
yeah,
resistance to like this fucking like neoliberal assault on the third world. And again, in Mali, you have this organization called Office Riz Moptiz. It's this World Bank funded organization in charge of like turning typically communal pastoralist land into rice farms. And even like tribal chiefs, who are a fairly conservative element of Fulani society, they hate this. Researchers write, people interviewed in the Delta, the Inner Niger Delta, or locally called the Masina, in 2006, also stressed that neither farmers nor pastoralists were consulted on when ORM, the World Bank funded office, confiscated burgu or pasture land and enclosed livestock corridors. One Jora, that is a chief who is in charge of like who gets to pasture where, said that the office robbed his community of land worth many billions of French African francs. He called it an aggressive holdup and added that ORM, it's a disaster. Another Joro added that everything ORM has done is bad. So all of these practices, like they're irritating even like typically elite members of the society. I keep emphasizing, like, this is a very like unstable and very troublesome structure, basically. And then on top of this, you have the social revolt from like low caste Fulani who are like descended of slaves. Gilles Holder, he writes, thus, whatever the depth of the religious faith that motivates the jihadists of the 21st century, and while we must not obscure the stakes of globalized jihadism, the commitment of slaves by descent to take violence takes on a fairly precise meaning: to free themselves from their subaltern independent status by force, by reappropriating the jihad.
Yeah, I mean, you have the elements here, classic elements for insurgency.
Yes.
This is grounding the whole story as what you're doing here. So, you know, yeah, definitely appreciate that. Because as a rule, you know, the way when it does get reported, it's sort of like people fall prey to internet, you know, to radical ideas on the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, that does happen individually, but that doesn't create insurgencies like what we see in the Sahel.
A lot of Fulani youth will mention that, like, we're taking up arms because the government, or previously the French, and now just the government, the junta government, are mistreating our communities. So we're not going to stand for this. Obviously, jihadism, like the the person I spoke to, Flo, like he very clearly shows that jihadism as an ideology has real sway, but it wouldn't have sway if these social problems didn't exist. It would be a much more fringe phenomenon. Fundamentally, this is like one pretty irritating thing about a lot of like Western analysts is that they'll focus too much on the ideology and not like why exactly does this fucking
right.
Like in a normal society, jihadism would not be that big.
Right.
Like this only attracts like really like, in very desperate circumstances. That's why it starts to take root.
Although, I mean, there is a history of jihadism as a way of gaining resources, like the Afghan jihad down, the Pashtun jihad down into India, the Ottoman jihad pushing in every direction to expand its borders and provide military occupation and plunder. There is a history of jihadism that is not just the resource of forlorn communities, but very powerful communities.
I think like the key nuance there is that jihad, for sure, like what you've mentioned, but jihadism as an ideology, it's after the like Ottomans. It's a very like 20th century ideology. Right. It's a very like, it's about as modern as like helicopters and like jets.
Okay, makes sense.
There's obvious lineage to the older jihads, but like, I don't think they can be like equated in the same way. But that's neither here nor there. So now returning back to like Jainism itself, we've like set the social stage. How does this manifest within their rhetoric and their politics? Well, first, one thing is this like really struck me when I like first read it is that Jainism routinely sides with low caste Fulani. It will give them priority or even exclusive right to pasture. It will boost, like it gives them guns. I mean, that's a big deal. Like once you have a gun and you're organized, you're able to do what you want. In the Masina, which is like the inner Niger Delta, it's very fertile, that's where pastoralists really go. It will abolish, in 2015 to 2018, it completely abolished all tithes and fees. Then it reinstated them at the request of tribal chiefs, but at a reduced rate.
What part of Mali is this in?
This is central Mali.
Central Mali, okay.
Like on a Google map, like you'll see that there's like this big green spot. That's the Masina.
I've seen that. But I'm trying to see if you had that map up in one of your Substacks, although I know I saw it.
I may have.
I'll post that map anyway so that people see it,
So their rhetoric and like Amadou Koufa, the Fulani chief of Jainism, he's always talking about like Sharia is the only way to bring about social justice or like social equity. What you mentioned about in the absence of socialism, jihadism takes its place. It's a very like overt example of that. Like all of this rhetoric, it's being filtered through jihadist ideology, but like you can easily see how it would be how it could be channeled by socialism, whether it's be a socialist or left wing force.
I mean, this is the target. This would have been the target of any Maoist insurgency or any, radical sort of left nationalist insurgency. Yeah.
So, and like there's this rhetoric that's come. There's that rhetoric. There's like actual practice of this. And what I found something interesting is that apparently ISGS, Islamic State Greater Sahara, which is the Jainism's most immediate competitor, I'll just quote the researchers, many dryland pastoralists rejected, however, to comply with this decision, that is to reinstate fees at a lower rate, arguing that the Holy Quran states that pastures are a free gift from God. They therefore asked for a reversal of the decision, but the Jainism Shura, their sort of a leadership council, still decided to keep the fees. This resulted in many pastoralists leaving Katiba Masina, which is one of the constituents of Jainism, to join Dawlat al-Islamiyya, which is a group established in late 2019 that has become part of Islamic State in Greater Sahara. So there's this like competition within jihadist groups to cater to the needs of pastoralists.
I'm kind of surprised that I would have thought Islamic State is kind of more overtly sort of reactionary and hierarchical in a sense than Jainism. I don't know. I don't know why I would think that. I guess they're being formed by local circumstances. I don't know.
Your impression isn't wrong. Until quite recently, ISGS was widely considered to be a very predatory organization, even by people who were like pro-jihadist like leaning. They seem to have like somewhat calmed down now that they've like become a lot weaker and like can't afford to be a psycho. It's still a very interesting, like, as you said, you wouldn't really expect it. And the rhetoric, of course, of of Jainism has shifted. It like it's as the French were leaving, like when the French were there, the Malian state, the Sahelian states were denounced as like these are pro-crusader entities.
Right.
But as the French are kicked out, the rhetoric shifts, as I mentioned earlier. Amadou Koufa denounces the Malian state as a Bambara state, like calling on this sort of like this pre-colonial history of like the Fulani jihad against the Bambara Empire, this sort of affirmative like affirmation of Fulani identity, both like as inheritors of this jihad and as against the Bambara regime, so to speak. And this, of course, is like winning them enormous popularity. Like the Fulani, although it's wrong to view them as like the jihadist ethnicity because that worsens tensions and causes like needless ethnic strife, it's still a fact that they are disproportionately the fighters in these movements. That's the, I would say, the bedrock of this. There's the bedrock sort of social foundation. But there's another aspect, which is illicit gold extraction. That's much easier to get your head around. It's basically, in a nutshell, in like 2010-ish, there was this giant fucking gold ore vein discovered across the Sahel. And it created this boom in artisanal mining. There's like 2 million people directly dependent on artisanal mining in the three big Sahel states. But there's like 6 million.
The three big Sahel, I'm sorry to cut you off. I got to do the journalism thing. To repeat, that would be Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, right?
Yes. So 2 million people directly employed by this informal industry, but 6 million like in total, like if, once you include like all the people as like the broader network, dependent on this. So it's a huge part of the local economies. And naturally, the jihadists are very involved. It again ties back to this this like land question, where the governments, obviously they want this mining regulated so that they can tax and monitor where it's going, right? But in doing so, say they take over like an ore vein and then they give a concession to, this is before the current juntas, which are like very hostile to mining companies, but still sort of like for illustration, like when the liberal governments were in power, they would give these concessions to foreign companies, which would then like be able to actually like monitor and tax and you're able to like somewhat like make sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
But this obviously irritates local people because they're like, what the fuck? This is like, we're not able to, like, we have to work for these companies now. We're not able to profit from it directly. Or in some cases, like if it's in a nature reserve, we're not able to mine this at all. So this is another aspect where the jihadists are able to tap into popular resentments and directly profit from it, but literally and figuratively. So with jihadists, initially their relations with the miners, or not initially, for a good while actually, were extremely violent. They would attack mines and kill a bunch of miners saying, like, listen, if you're not going to work with us, this is the consequence. Over time, as the government started losing control and as the jihadists started taking more and more mines, there's this really striking Financial Times article from June of 2021. So, like, this is over 3 years old now. It's a map of Burkina Faso and then, like, all the artisanal mines and then an overlap of, like, where James Fear is. And it's almost one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And that was over 3 years ago now. So you can imagine how bad the situation is now.
Again, I don't know. There is, as you've been saying, this kind of overlap between leftist insurgency. I mean, they do a lot of what leftist insurgencies would do. They go in there rhetorically and perhaps otherwise, you know, siding with the people who are sort of most oppressed or have the largest grievances against the tiny minority of those who are getting everything. And they also kind of set up a parallel or alternative governance system, a lot of which is protection, right?
Yeah.
And then and taxing and protection. And it seems that usually they're actually doing it in a way that's winning over people, which is the old Maoist way, but not always.
It's a sort of a carrot and stick approach. Within, I'd say, the Sahelian sort of jihadist politics, Jainism is definitely preferred amongst rural people because it's less extreme than ISGS. People have especially bad memories of ISGS because it's from like older accounts from like 2018, 2019, 2020. The way people described ISGS is like a locust horde came in and just took everything. So obviously for that reason, they like lean more towards Jainism. And then also Jainism is just sort of, it has older roots through Akim, like through this older struggle. But what ends up happening is that obviously, like, people are going to, like, they're siding with these organizations, or many people, I shouldn't say, like, people in general, are siding with JNIM, and so that they can continue this illicit mining. But the governments have a very valid reason to oppose this. They're not able to tax these revenues. They're not able to control what's going on. And they obviously don't want this money going to jihadists who are fighting and killing them. But the ways that they're currently trying to solve this are very counterproductive. But, like, if by closing off mining in these places, people are just going to be like, all right, fuck you. You're like, you're vindicating what the jihadists say. So we're just going to side with them. It's this very vicious feedback loop. And the parapolitical element of this, which I haven't gone into, the UAE is the destination for basically all illicitly mined gold in Africa, from Sudan to the Sahel, probably, like, and through all of Africa. They're this fucking, like, the UAE's role in the world is unbelievably malevolent.
It is. We talk about it a lot on the show. Yeah. They're like the old Venetian Republic. They're just so much more powerful than this little maritime state, you would think. They have an empire. Yeah, and you do a really good job in this article, in this piece, making it very clear how that chain of, you know, artisanal mining, smuggling to Dubai to market, how it works. Could you describe that for us? I thought that was we've talked about it on the show with James Pogue. We had a great episode with him last summer about Sahel and Mali. And Joshua Craze talked about it with Sudan, but I really like how you describe it in your piece here.
Yeah, so it's a bit, the two big, like, within the three Sahel states, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, the two really big producers are Burkina Faso and Mali. Mali kind of makes sense because, like, you know, like not Sandia, the Mansa Musa, like, the, you know, like the story of, like, him bringing gold everywhere. Like, Mali has a strong tradition of gold production. But those are the two big producers, and they have slightly different, or actually, like, quite different ways in which this stuff is exported illegally. Malian gold is flown straight out of Bamako International Airport. It's sent straight to Dubai. Whereas Burkinabe gold, it's trafficked through Togo, and then in Togo, which has no mines of its own, it's shipped to Dubai.
Tax, right? Or something like that? Like, there's another reason? Yeah, or super low tax, right?
To elaborate a bit further about the Bamako route, it's kind of amazing just how fucking criminal it is. Buyers in Bamako often pre-finance with foreign capital, which, I mean, like, that immediately raises questions of, like, how is that not being monitored? Acquire gold nuggets from artisanal miners and smugglers. At the city's various refining facilities, they melt these nuggets into bars and ship them abroad. By paying off local customs and airport officials, their couriers can easily leave Bamako for Dubai with bars of artisanal gold stowed in their hand luggage. Buyers in Dubai prize the great bars of African gold since they can keep the other precious minerals that are separated out during the refining process, such as silver, palladium, and platinum. Those can compose, like, up to 10% of a bar's original mass. Yeah. So it isn't just gold that they're getting. They're getting a whole lot more. Sometimes even foreign buyers from the UAE, Turkey, and even Russia will go straight to these giant, like, artisanal mines, like the Intihaka mine. And since these mines, like, it's very bizarre.
Who provides protection for the mines?
Well, I'm about to get into that. loosely pro-government militant groups, because the state isn't strong enough to have, like, its own, like, the military isn't big enough. It's like the FAMA is about 40,000. So, like, it has to rely on these, like, additional levies, or additional, like, these auxiliary paramilitary groups. These groups will levy their own taxes on gold as per treaties with Bamako. So this is, like, somewhat official. But jihadists, they don't sign these treaties. So they continue their attacks on the mines and on these groups. And once they take control, they unilaterally take the proceeds. That's how it works in Mali. So there's this competition between pro-government militias and the jihadists. And then obviously the government's trying to somewhat police and take control of, like, this illicit traffic.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but whoever, to control basically the governance and security, but whoever's in control, JNIM or, a pro-government militia, it's all still going to it's all still going to Dubai.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It's just really who gets to wet their beaks off it on the way to Dubai.
Exactly. That's the other, this is why I think, like, the UAE is very openly anti-Islamist and anti-jihadist, but they're also extremely cynical and like fucking insane. Yes. So I haven't found, like, solid evidence of this yet, but I personally believe that they have some kind of backroom deal with Janum. I think like, there's no way that these foreign buyers aren't aware of who is bringing this gold to them.
They wouldn't see Janum necessarily as a threat to them anyway. It's so far away. And, you know, and they'll always think we've got them sort of locked into a business arrangement that's very important for them. But, you know, like you said, like they don't, they're very anti-Islamist on the one hand, but on the other hand, they're also just ruthlessly cynical and very smart, very effective and very brutal. Yeah, sort of empire that they run. So, yeah.
And so that's Mali. In Burkina Faso, it's even more sort of like criminal, like just like on the way it functions. Gold flows out of Burkina Faso across like porous land borders in cars and buses, sometimes even like strapped to cattle and like on like or wagons. And then all this stuff, it goes into neighboring countries like Ghana, Benin, sometimes even Niger, but especially Togo, due to low taxes on gold exports. So in 2018, Togo exported 24 tons of gold to the UAE, but having no natural resources of gold of its own. Then once it finally arrives in the UAE, it's refined into jewelry that's sold to the rest of the world. It's like, it's this very, like, you have all this human suffering being condensed into the most like kitschy shit. It isn't even going to like anything. I don't know how to describe it. Like, it's just so almost like postmodern.
In a way, it's like Switzerland. I mean, Switzerland is built on loot from plunder and blood money, you know, and they're all rich and happy there. And arresting Ali Abu Nima on the way, you know.
Fucking Nazi country.
Yes, totally.
So that's how the like the land question, the social question, and the gold question, it all ties into Janum as like the, or Janum in particular and jihadism in general in the Sahel. I think maybe we can move on now to like the state of Janum today, based on my reports.
Yes.
So I in one of my pieces, I bring in a map from TRAC, Terrorism Tracking Terrorism. That map is pretty grim, but like I added a note that like this is still an underestimate of how bad things are, because just from attack claims, like Janum and ISGS are a lot bigger than most maps suggest, and they're rapidly growing. Although I think this year they're gonna like, at least Janum, last year was a year of huge, the last like 2023, 2024 were years of very big territorial gains for them. I think this year they will focus on consolidating their gains and ensuring that they have strong social networks and logistics networks in these territories.
Can you describe it? I mean, I'll post this map, but can you just tell like what this map comprises of, or just looking at it, you know, I mean, Janum is, it's got a lot of presence there, as do the two IS groups, but yeah.
According to New Humanitarian, at least 40% of Burkina Faso is out of the government's control. I personally think that number is probably closer to 50, maybe even 60%. Given how many attacks are happening and the scale of those attacks, and assuming the government is obviously fighting very hard. It's trying its best, but it's not doing enough. Like it just isn't enough. Similarly with Mali, in Burkina Faso, most of it is like on the northern reaches of the country, the northern northeastern reaches. So like the places bordering Mali, Niger, Nigeria, Benin, like that whole arc is Janum/ISGS. In Mali, you have the Massina, which is in the central region. You have Kidal, which is the capital of the big triangle, like north of northern Mali, and you have Timbuktu, and now increasingly in the west in Kayes State near Mauritania. Those are all Janum territories, and then bordering Niger, you have this region called Menaka. That's ISGS, but from what seems to be the case, Janum is trying to get that ISGS branch to defect to itself, and they've had some successes with getting ISGS people to defect. In northern Burkina Faso, which has ISGS presence, their top commander was killed by his two bodyguards, who then defected to Janum, which is a really that didn't get that much news, but that's a very big deal for like people that high up to be to defect. It shows that ISGS is in a lot of trouble politically, like within the jihadist scene. then a few weeks later, JNIM published an image of an ISGS squadron declaring loyalty to JNIM. So this is clearly happening. And Flo actually told me, now who is Flo? We've mentioned him a lot already. Flo is this, he says he's a Libyan Tuareg who moved to Timbuktu. And Flo is very ideologically pro-jihadist. So like you have to take what he says with some salt, but the more I spoke to him, the more I picked his brain, the more it was abundantly clear that this is someone who actually knows what he's talking about. He isn't just a fan. And one of the pieces, just to illustrate why I trust him, and Mark, I'm sure like this probably shocked you as well. Flo told me during the HTS, the rebel offensive in Syria, he told me that Huras ad-Din, the AQ branch in Syria, right, were fighting in the offensive, which no one else had reported that. Mm. And I that was somewhat hard to believe for me because I thought Huras ad-Din is quite small and they have a lot of bad blood with HTS.
Yeah.
But weeks later, journalists confirmed that Huras ad-Din had in fact fought in the offensive. And not only that, they did it against the orders of their leadership. So you have two incentives to keep this quiet. One is AQ doesn't want to sort of tarnish the reputation of HTS as like this in quotes revolutionary group.
Right.
Like associating it with it's much more like AQ realizes that its brand is can be quite toxic.
Yeah. It'll bring in like the Americans and whatever, yeah, possibly. So yeah, you want to keep it quiet.
Yeah. So you have that incentive, but then you have the other incentive that the fighters, they don't want to reveal this internal tension within Huras ad-Din. And yet Flo still knew this and he told me and some others. If he knows something like that, I'm very willing to trust him. I think that's a good reason as good as any to believe what he says. But still people are entitled to be skeptical.
I was just wondering about your map to the east. Specifically, I was surprised to see that, Islamic State West Africa seems to have pretty much displaced Boko Haram,
yeah,
around Maiduguri.
Yeah, that's the northeast of Nigeria, which borders Chad and sort of Niger up yeah, in the kind of northeast, but yeah,
most Chad. The story behind that is basically Boko Haram, the original Boko Haram, they defected to IS, but the original leader, this guy named Sheikhou, he was insane, even by IS standards, which is really...
him, yeah.
Sheikhou is one of the most bizarre jihadist characters I've ever read about and like seen his videos. I mean, just watch, like, if you can find his videos like on Twitter or whatever, I recommend it because just sort of shows what level of unreality he operated on.
It was really wild. yeah.
So IS, essentially, they were like, fuck off, we don't want you. And most of Boko Haram, the fighters and the commanders, they stuck with IS. They actually had a very vicious war with the remnants of Boko Haram, the ones who were still loyal to Sheikhou. They got rid of them all except a couple pockets in the northeast. And now what was Boko Haram has turned into ISWAP, which is this very organized, very deadly jihadist movement. They recently released a very high production video, production value video, showing foreign fighters, Arabs, Iraqis, and apparently one Palestinian, which is like, what the fuck? Why is a Palestinian? Why are you there instead of, you know, Gaza or like the West Bank?
Yeah.
And that also comes after last year, in early 2024, the spokesman for IS urging foreign fighters to come to Africa. IS is really investing most of its resources in Africa. Like, it sees that as the new frontier for its project. And this is, I think, partially because of the stiff competition it's facing in the historical lands of jihad in the Middle East and in AFPAC. In AFPAC, the Taliban, they won in Afghanistan, and they're winning against the Pakistani government in Pakistan. In Syria, HTS ate IS's lunch. In Iraq, their name is far too discredited because Sunni Iraqis know what suffering comes from IS. So they're in a lot of trouble there. So they're investing all their resources into Africa, in IS Mozambique, in IS Somal and Somalia, which is currently fighting off an offensive from Puntland forces. Right. In apparently they've just issued a call for jihad in Sudan, in Congo, obviously Nigeria, Niger, and in the Sahel like region broadly. So they're dumping in a lot of effort. And Flo, now to get back to Flo, he, now that like a sort of as having established his credibility, so to speak, he's shared a number of extremely interesting details, a lot of which have been corroborated since he first shared them with me. Mm-hmm. Let's first get into the dynamics between Akim, AQI, Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, and JNIM. What is the relationship? I alluded to this earlier. And Flo informed me that they're basically the same organization. You can't meaningfully, like separating them as like, treating them as distinct organizations is silly. That's how big the contribution of AQIM is in JNIM.
Right. He seemed confused by the fact that you even tried to create a difference in, of the two groups. And he was like, what are you talking about? They're the same thing. Yeah.
It's very, and, but all AQIM, their leadership council, is based in Kabylie in Algeria, which I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And it seems that they make the final decisions on really big operations, not operations, but like opening up new fronts, basically. Flo, he discussed Nigeria and like why there isn't a jihad open there. Like why hasn't JNIM struck? And this is what he said. Nigeria is a large country, and to open a jihadist arena with it requires great effort. Perhaps it even requires a decision from the Shura Council of Al-Qaeda in Algeria, referring to AQIM, not just JNIM. Opening a military front with a big country like Nigeria is never easy because it may drain the group's resources. But building good relations with the tribes costs nothing. And that, it's a constant motif whenever he talks about it, is JNIM's relations with local African tribes. The scale of this is far bigger than, like, I think any official, like, any, like, big website is reporting right now. It's, other analysts I've spoken to have agreed that, like, the reports right now that you can find are, they're not showing the full scale. To give a sense of just how big it is, JNIM has relations with the tribes in the three big Sahel states, but it also has relations with the tribes in, like, the littoral states, the coastal states, like in Benin, Togo, Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Nigeria. But for me, the most shocking one was that they have relations with people, apparently or allegedly, in Chad. And that's a ways away. It takes a lot of effort to fucking go all the way to Chad from like Burkina Faso.
But these relationships are like what they're developing are personal relationships, developing trust, maybe intermarriage, maybe some kind of commerce or something, but they're putting down roots, but they're not actually, we're not talking about any military activities, right?
Like, right. It seems to be the imperial playbook that I mentioned, like, like penetrating like the lower ranks of society, like intermarriage, business relations, et cetera, and then slowly proselytizing.
Well, yeah, but in Nigeria, it might also be that traditionally, I mean, ever since the British colonial state, the Islamists of the north have been dominant, and the Biafra War settled that once and for all, that the literal tribes are not going to have power here.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Fulani, Flo reported that the Fulani, there's loads of Nigerian Fulani in Burkina Faso and in Mali. So there, that's obviously like a dynamic. He also mentions, he cryptically mentions the Hausa, and he says, the Hausa are spread along the river and borders, and some of them are in Nigeria. Their language is difficult. You can hardly understand it, which I find that such an interesting comment, suggesting that he has contacts, like direct contacts with Hausa, like sympathizers or jihadists. It is one of God's blessings that when the brothers of Al-Qaeda in Algeria first came to the scene, they reconciled the tribes and removed grudges between them. Again, this is the imperial playbook that I mentioned earlier. Like he's... Very first-hand verification that this sort of abstract theory is correct.
Yeah.
So this is what's going on in Nigeria. They're already building roots. And the fruits of it, according to Flo, is that JNIM can field 120,000 operatives, which I already stated my reservations with that figure. I think that probably represents their hardcore of support, like people who really ideologically support them. And the breakdown in Mali, he says that there's about 30,000 in Massina, the Niger Inner Delta, the green spot in the middle of the country, and 15,000 in Timbuktu. He calls Timbuktu and Kidal, the Tuareg capital, the social incubators of the movement. And elsewhere, he also described Massina similarly. So I found, like, that was another description I found fascinating, social incubator. It's this very, like,
What does he mean exactly by that? Like, it's interesting though, yeah.
That is the social support base of Jainism. Like that.
That's their natural deepest base. Yes. Is what that area, those areas produce. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose, and it makes sense. Like Timbuktu, Kidal is like their Tuareg capital. They have their own beast with the Malian state. Timbuktu is like another like very historical region. And Messina, like where the pastoralists often come. Like all these, like the social contradictions in these places, it makes them particularly receptive to radical ideologies. In this case, Al-Qaeda-type jihadism. Now, for the exact figures, again, this is unclear. I think they probably have like 30, 35,000, at most 40,000. UN claims 5,000 to 6,000, which I think is way off. I don't think it's anywhere near close to what the real number is.
When I think of UN figures, I think about the Gulf states with the U.S., the war on the Houthis on Sirte that started in 2015. And I just remember they said 10,000 had been killed like sometime in the middle of 2015. And that number stayed exactly fixed up through about 2020. All the reports would still say, according to the UN, 10,000 people have been killed. Like it never changed. So yeah, they have issues with figures unless somebody really lights a fire under them, you know, or something. Yeah.
So there's this, and UN reports like even further, like on the one hand, they are a valuable source of information. I mean, any source of information is useful, like, but them I think is like worth paying attention to. But at the same time, it's like they get their information from like neighboring states, like given a particular conflict zone. And who knows what the biases are of those, like of their interlocutors.
They don't want to offend people and yeah. God knows.
So you have all these dynamics going on. I think like maybe Algeria is probably exercising some influence here in kind of understating the influence of Jainism, probably because it's like if people sort of comprehended how bad the situation was, first off, I mean, there'd be a lot of questions like, what the fuck was France doing in the 10 years that they were there? Of like, how you guys spent 10 years here and now this mess is even bigger than it was when you started. And then second, now that France is gone, people will ask, Algeria is the next most powerful country in the region, why aren't you doing anything?
And why is their headquarters in the center of your country, basically?
Yeah, it's a lot of like, it's very parapolitical, but like, it's hard to find information. I think with France, a lot of like the juntas, they sort of transparently, they say like, all this is orchestrated by France. I think that's bogus. I don't think like any of these like jihadist movements are orchestrated by like any foreign forces. I think they're often instrumentalized, as with ISKP, which I discussed before. But there's still like organic reasons as to why they emerge. I think what really like France's parapolitical role early on, after there was Operation Serval, which deposed the jihadist emirate in 2012 or 2013. Then there was Operation Barkhane, the one that like took fucking forever and that like ended in disgrace for France. From what I like reading in between the lines and like French reports and, you know, sort of making sense of the conflict, France had made this very bizarre move, which was to reinstall a bunch of the Tuareg so-called secular separatist leaders in the north as a way to like, oh, we can't totally trample on Tuareg demands, right? But this obviously infuriated the Malian government and a lot of the southern population because they were like, what the fuck? These people are a clear threat to the state. Now, on the one hand, you have the French racial fetish for the Tuareg. On the other hand, again, reading in between the lines, what seems to be the thing is that France probably thought that these were a useful justification. These people were a useful justification for their continued presence in the country. And it was always like sort of an open secret that the Tuareg separatist movements have a porous relationship with jihadists. Even back then, when the separatists were much stronger compared to the jihadists. Nowadays, like, I'm sure it'll sometimes come up in the news about like, oh, Tuareg separatists did this or that. They're all subordinated to Jainism.
So that attack on the Wagner that killed that like Jainism. 80 Russians, that was Jainism. Okay, that was not the Tuareg. Okay,
that's the thing. The Tuareg were also involved, but they worked with Jainism.
Right.
Obviously, they're separatists and like they're fucking they're ghoulish boosters abroad, like with the Hudson Institute. They kept that part quiet. But the Hudson Institute, they have amazing research, but they have some of the most malevolent figures I've ever encountered in this space. Yeah. Like they have this one woman, this one I think Algerian Berber woman.
I know who you're talking about.
Who was like boosting the Tuareg separatists. And I was like, wait a minute, she was like boosting that particular attack. I go like, this is anyone can see, like anyone who knows anything about this region knows that that was done with Jaden. Like, how the fuck are you so shamelessly boosting this person and like the agenda she's promoting? So I think that was a big part of the French initiative. Then it sort of like got out of their control when they were like, oh, wait a minute, this has gotten a bit bigger than we thought it would. And right now, Jaynim, it's just sort of incomprehensible, just the information that's starting to come out.
But you said, though, since you've gone deep into this, it's very clear that they have their own, like, they don't need to be sponsored completely by, you know, by a NATO country or something the way, you know, certain really instrumentalized jihadi groups have been, like, you know, whatever, in Syria, mm-hmm. Afghanistan 40 years ago, because they have their own revenue streams. Like, they've built it up from the ground up, and they have leadership and experienced leadership that they can tap into and have tapped into, that is from Algeria. Like, they have their entire, I don't know, ecosystem or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, but on the other hand, it's hard to ignore. I mean, one of the elephants in the room here, of course, is Russia. To the extent Russia, how deeply they're really involved. I mean, they're the only way a story gets written about any of this, usually. You know, we talked with James Pogue a bit about this, and James's attitude, he spent a lot of time in Mali, went to Burkina Faso, is that the Russian presence there is very thin, very pretty hollow. And, you know, and I think that's absolutely right. That seems right to me. And they don't seem to have been having any more luck, as far as I can tell, than the French, except that they're doing it off books rather than the state involved. You know, they privatized it, so it doesn't cost the government the same. But it also makes it harder for them to do what, as you've pointed out, what needs to be done, which is, you know, redressing all of these social grievances. Like, Wagner or Africa Corps, whatever they're called now, is like, they're a gold trading company as well as mercenaries. So
they're like, you basically, like what you said, it nails it. I feel like the way the West talks about Russian presence in the Sahel, it's very paper thin. And like, oftentimes when they come up against the jihadists, they don't do that well in combat. Like that one from a couple months ago, 80 fucking Wagner guys got smoked. And in one of their Telegram channels, they were complaining that this is too hard. Like, this is like too much. This is like, we got more than we bargained for.
That particular, attack, like, was so, as I remember reading about it too, I mean, it was so well executed. Mm-hmm. This was not going up against, like, I don't know, just, this is not an easy, poorly trained, poorly armed, inexperienced, you know, bunch of fanatics. This is a really, these are people who know the terrain and know battle tactics and executed it perfectly, and that freaked them out.
Like, in general, the focus on Russia is very, it's just this part of this, like this great power bullshit. I find it like, the main dynamic is that they basically intensify a lot of the worst shit that was part of the French counter-terror, counter-jihadist strategy, which is like, oftentimes it's like deputizing locals to commit abuses. And Wassim Nasser is a great French journalist, although should be viewed with some suspicion. He's a lot of people have told me that like he's probably a spy, which I believe.
A lot of spies could be good journalists. You know, so there is a lot of that going on. Yeah. But yeah.
So Wassim Nasser, he sent a questionnaire to Amadou Koufa, the second in command of Jaynim. And Amadou Koufa, he answered most of the questions. And one thing that he stated was that we obviously hated France and we wanted them gone, and we're glad that they're gone. But we found that Wagner is an even better recruiting tool for us because they let these abuses happen and people want to fight back. We've had like a boon in recruiting because of this. So obviously like Wagner is very hated amongst a lot of people, but as far as like the jihadist politics goes, they're doing the jihadists a favor, which again, a lot of like the most ghoulish Western analysts will go, haha, like this is, like Russia is backfiring, or like with this Schadenfreude to the juntas. But this is all still rooted in like what France is doing.
Mm-hmm, of course.
They had like, it's not as if that they were like any more humane. And their presence was far bigger. and Wagner, yep. and it still ended in total defeat. They like finally left last year. Or no,
but yeah, it goes back. There's a century of grievances that it's built on, and not just their, you know, culminating, I guess, in the failed counterinsurgency. But there's a lot of historical grievance there, and the way that France exerts power. I mean, even just, you know, as you were talking about, like the French bank controlled like African franc. Mm-hmm. There are just so many ways that France kind of has power over these state sovereignty. That's very deeply resented. I don't know, you know, this may be outside of what you were writing about, but have you followed much how the different junta leaders politically kind of are dealing with this? Because some of them have kind of styled themselves on like 60s, 70s yeah. anti-colonialist, and seem to have kind of tacked left, kind of left nationalist, But I don't know enough, you know.
It's very, the aesthetic is definitely there. Like, I mean,
yeah.
As for like the actual substance of the politics, it's hard to, a lot of this is like mired in like fake news from like these like anonymous Twitter accounts that like are always boosting.
Bullshit.
Like, oh, they like nationalized a bunch of mines, white in territory that they don't control.
Like,
we got to be a bit real here. As for the actual policies, I'm kind of pretty skeptical. For instance, a lot of people boast like their anti-colonial credentials, but all of these governments, like Traoré, Goïta in Mali, and then I forget the last guy in Niger, they were all trained by AFRICOM. Mm. Like all of these governments are filled with AFRICOM people, and they have very fond like relations with the U.S. They recently signed in Burkina Faso. They recently signed another like IMF loan. Like, they're very clearly embedded in the system. Their animosity is directed very squarely at France for understandable reasons. It's totally justified. Yeah. But this is, I think, like being blown up by like fairly naive, like people who are pretty naive and like don't like haven't read that much. They're blowing it up into something that it isn't.
That's a good point. It is very much directed at France, and yeah, they seem to have fairly good relations with the Americans, but they can't really do it openly.
Yeah. Recently, Flo had another conversation with him. I haven't like documented it yet, but he said that the Americans, he alleged rather, that the Americans are providing assistance to the juntas through Benin and Togo. Benin and Togo are both very solid Western allies. The current PM of Benin, Financial Times positively compared him to Paul Kagame, which is very, says a lot.
Yeah.
In general, I don't think like, on the one hand, obviously, like the West is very concerned about Africa because, you know, like wants to keep fucking plundering this continent. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think it's got bigger fish to fry, given like the competition with Russia, now the imminent competition or the ongoing competition with China.
Yeah.
Like it's this, I think a lot of this is very much, how do I put it? It's very complex.
Yeah.
To put it very mildly. Mm.
Well, I mean, as we've followed on the show, you know, it's pretty clear that the American, the national security state, et cetera, just decided a good 10 years ago that they didn't like the war on terror, the global war on terror, the GWAT anymore, that they didn't like counterinsurgency as a rule, and they wanted to move back to the big Cold War stuff. These were big budgets. You don't actually necessarily fight the wars. You do proxy wars. But, like, you have a big enemy, China, big enemy, Russia, and that requires big-ticket items. I mean, right, John? I mean,
ships.
We've seen
lots
this.
Lots of ships.
Ships, yeah. And so getting involved in this is sort of like, well, like, the optics are bad if you lose, you know, four special forces people in some ambush. The optics are really bad. The country's mood is against interventions. And for what? So they're kind of, yeah, they don't want this. They don't want to prioritize this, very deliberately don't want to.
No, and for that matter, ships come into it in an oblique way in that these places are in the middle of a very large continent. Mm-hmm. And America has traditionally been a coastal empire. You'd rather mess around with some place you can send a few carriers to.
Yeah, what's that giant navy for anyway?
And I think also we haven't, like, this is another dynamic, like, within jihadism in the Sahel, is the organized crime element.
Yes.
obviously, like, this is like with any conflict, there's like a huge black market that goes on. But here, I think it's a very, this is a very key element. Flo, he told me, he has a weird sense of humor. As for the tribes, I will not mention the names of the tribes in particular, but I will speak in general. All right, thanks, man. They say that if you reach southern Libya, you have already reached Jainim. This is what they often say. The group actually has a base in southern Libya and among the southern tribes as well. There are many of our brothers from the regions of Libya present in Jainim today. The brothers from Libya are mainly in Timbuktu region and some areas of Messina, such as Mopti and Segu, also possibly in Gawa and Arabanda. As for the leader, Talha Abu Hind, he is originally from Libya and his family is also present in Timbuktu and is nomadic. There are many Libyan tribes that have people and families in the Timbuktu desert. Here, he's implicitly referring to himself because he's Libyan Tuareg. So, I mean, that right. I mean, this is, I think like the only like other report I've seen mention Jainim's presence in southern Libya was a UN report, and there it really understated it. Southern Libya is like this fucking no-go zone, not no-go zone, just like no man's land filled with criminal, like smuggling networks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very sort of oblique. And apparently what Jainim right now is trying to do is secure drone tech through Libya into its territories in the Sahel. It's already shown off some of this with its camera footage, but they don't yet know how to use the drones. They don't have like indigenous tech, like expertise yet. They're trying to build that
interesting.
Up. Because what's clear from combat and like from Flo's reports is that the juntas, they have drones. They get they buy them,
and
they
the Russians would have them too. So
they buy them from the Russians and the Turks, and these drones are easily their most potent weapon. And with it, like, this is like the main thing that's able to keep off the jihadists. And so Jainim is very eager to get its own arsenal built up and like get some real expertise in. But Jainim, what's interesting is that, as you mentioned, Mark, is building a lot of this stuff like sort of from the ground up. Islamic State, ISGS, and ISWAP, IS in general is a very centralized organization across the globe. There's a lot of coordination across the branches. I mentioned earlier that there's Iraqis, Palestinians in ISWAP, in the Nigerian branch. Flo told me that there's Iraqis in ISGS in the leadership positions, and they're the most bellicose members. They want to declare war on Jainim right away. I think that there will be war sooner or later, sooner, because IS, it's the biggest threat to it, more than jets, more than counterinsurgent operations, is successful rival jihadists, because that really takes the wind out of their sails. Their whole thing is, we're the only people who can beat the infidels and implement Sharia. But what happens when other people do that? When the Taliban do it, when HTS does it, when Jainim is doing it, it completely dilutes their core selling point. And this is why the defections are happening. And this is why I think ISGS will really start pushing first war against Jainim and second integration with ISWAP. They've been trying to form a physical link for a while now. This year is going to be pretty important in seeing how that
Because they're physically separated by most of southern Niger, at least according to the map. But I'm sure they have routes where they can communicate, but they're not actually anywhere near physically.
What seems to be like the physical, the people who like intermediate between across branches, it seems to be mostly Iraqis and Syrians. Recently, there was a big arrest of like, I think, 9 or 10 Iraqi and Syrian IS operatives in Madagascar and in Cote d'Ivoire. And they were trying to plan attacks. Just the other day, there was a major string of attacks foiled in Angola against like 4 different major facilities
in the capital.
It's unclear who's done it yet, but it was allegedly planned in northern Burkina Faso, which means IS. Like, it has to have been ISGS. And it's still a developing story. We're still like learning what's going on. But first off, Jainim AQ, they don't do attacks like that anymore. They have local priorities, so to speak. Like, IS is the main, they're the ones most enthusiastic about that kind of operation.
Right.
And given like what we already know about the transnational IS network in Africa, I think it was probably Iraqi and Syrian operatives involved in some capacity.
Interesting.
And that, like, again, this is still speculative. This is just conjecture. Right. This would, like, perhaps, this would corroborate Flo's claims of Iraqis and ISGS, which I personally, I actually do believe that. If they have Iraqis and ISWAP, they probably have Iraqis and ISGS.
Mm-hmm.
The broader network in general is very I think there's this kind of, this is a hypothesis I'm working on. This is not a theory, so again, take it with salt. I think there is this like sort of transnational African jihadist network that it's like this super network that like works with anyone who is jihadist. There are sub networks which mm-hmm. lean towards one way or another. Like Libya is clearly agnostic. It works because there's an IS presence there as well. The literal states are agnostic. Madagascar seems to be pro IS, like the network mm-hmm. there. The base in northern Somalia, Somalia seems pretty like pro IS. That is like those territories outside of AS, like Al-Shabaab, which is pro Al Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And in Sudan, the UN reports there's about 120 operatives there, IS, from Iraq and Syria, led by the cousin of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Mm. That's pretty precise information, so they probably have something good.
Right.
But it's still fucking weird. The reason I find this, like, this hypothesis is based on an older one from Nebraska Zimi. He argued essentially the same thing, that, like, in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a pan-Middle Eastern jihadist super network that was, like, seeding Iraq in the event of, like, a big opportunity. That is 2003. Mm. And it wasn't related to Al-Qaeda. It was just like a bunch of people like doing seed capital to see where things go. And I suspect a similar process might be working now in Africa, possibly Sudan, possibly Libya. It's still a hypothesis. Like I still have to learn more. But one thing is for sure, the jihadists, both Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, are very interested in the future of jihad in Africa. And they are definitely making their own plans as to where and like what shape that takes. We'll just have to find out.
This has been great. I have one question I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. How did the victory of HTS, which as we know, you know, was an Al-Qaeda affiliate and came out of, you know, the split in Islamic State, has their victory there and the way that they have been embraced by the West, is that talked about from what you can see? Has that been a morale booster? Or like seen as like, this is where we go to, or?
It's a very good question. Al-Qaeda is definitely very enthusiastic, even though they have like very bad blood with HTS.
Yeah.
Because Al-Qaeda, they're pan-jihadists in a sense. Like they support any Sunni jihadists, mm-hmm. Even if they aren't like officially an AQ branch. IS is extremely jealous about its identity.
Yes.
It hates anyone who isn't like,
yeah.
who isn't part of it. And when it plays nice with other jihadists, the reason it does so, it's with the hope of flipping them over to become a branch. So IS has treated HTS with only contempt. It's been complaining very bitterly. And it reeks of them being sore losers that like someone else got the big victory against Assad.
IS are kind of like trots a little bit.
Yeah, no, legit. Like it really maps so well. The Taliban are Stalinists. Trots.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating though, IS, ever since HTS took over, IS hasn't done any attacks against them. There have been a couple foiled plots, like against the Sayyida Zainab shrine, the Shia shrine in Damascus, which allegedly the US gave that intel to HTS. So we already. And there's always rumors about them collaborating against ISIS or IS in Idlib before this happened. But IS, they issued a really striking warning to HTS, which was, if you accept membership from the UN or if you accept like the legitimacy of these international institutions, we will begin our attacks against you. Which I find that. They never gave that ultimatum to the Taliban. They were always fighting against them, even though the Taliban are much more like IS than HTS is, because the Taliban at least like implement Sharia.
Right.
And the reason I think they issued this warning, it was directed not at HTS leadership, but the extremists, the ultra extremists within HTS who want Sharia right now.
Right.
How I interpreted this warning was that, listen, you will see that your leadership will betray you. But we gave them a chance to implement Sharia. And once you see their betrayal, you'll know that we're here and we actually want Sharia.
Right.
That's what I think the move is. It's obviously very cynical. Like, even if they didn't issue it, like, IS will declare war on HTS for one reason or another. But it's a very clever political move.
Yeah.
AQ is obviously very happy about the victory. They clearly want Sharia. They've issued statements about it. But
JNIM doesn't talk about this really.
No. They issue statements on international affairs. Like they issued condolences. they issued congratulations to HTS for what for the successful offensive.
Yeah, there was an odd paragraph in Flo's manifesto or whatever it was about, even though we must criticize Hamas, and I was shocked. Like, what do you mean you must criticize Hamas? You try living under the Israeli Air Force.
Yeah.
That statement from Flo, I mean, first off, it's just sort of galling. Yeah. But even, like, setting that aside, I thought it was so striking how sympathetic even this, like, anonymous supporter was. That little paragraph, I think I mentioned in a footnote, but that almost verbatim was issued in the eulogies that issued from AQAP and Al-Qaeda Central for Sinwar. They basically said the same thing. Like, we support your cause. We support you against the Jews. We advise you to implement Sharia because that's the ultimate. That's what's necessary for any jihadist movement.
Hamas is not Islamist enough for them. Is that right?
Yeah, they want like Al-Qaeda. It's this. This is a bit of a like a digression. Since I know we're almost coming up on time, but
yeah,
Al-Qaeda. It was very angry when Hamas first entered the 2006 elections. It was like Zawahiri. He said like you've sold your religion. For democracy and liberalism. But AQ, it maintained this one stance, which was that the fighters, Hamas fighters and the Al-Qassam brigades, they're sincere. They are worthy of support. Now it seems to have gone back to its pre-2006 position, which is that Hamas overall is worthy of support, but we criticize and advise them about implementing Sharia. Mm. And it seems to be part of this broader shift in Al-Qaeda's strategy towards like a more pragmatic pan-Sunni politics, which is like we will work with anyone so long as they are Islamist.
Yeah, okay. I thought that stood out as a rather odd statement. Mm-hmm.
But the way you've explained it, and that makes sense, it was actually, compared to how that split has been, it was actually a much more friendly, positive, right, appraisal of Hamas from Al-Qaeda than they might have gotten, I don't know, 5 years ago or something. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been great. This has been fascinating. And, yeah. You know, it makes watching and reading about the Islamist insurgencies in the Sahel, it makes it a lot more understandable. So really appreciate it again, Rob Ashler.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
As always, thank you for having me on.
All right. Okay, let's end it here. Thank you again to Rob Ashler for talking to us, Radio Warner, about JNIM and the jihadis in the Sahel. And thanks, everyone. Thanks, John, Brendan, and talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Bye.
Okay, bye.